Hi, welcome to Agile Self-Development, the podcast that gives you a roadmap for personal growth and self-improvement for your body, mind, and spirit. Hi, I'm Helene Coppell, and together we'll take this journey to becoming our best self, one version at a time. On today's episode, we'll be talking to Dr. Robert Pepper, author of Some People Don't Want What They Say They Want, and a therapist who has been running groups for over 25 years. Dr. Pepper has a special gift in helping members resolve conflicts in relationships, both personal and professional. In the group therapy setting, members learn to resolve obstacles to developing healthy relationships through their interactions between members of that group. So I will let the expert tell it much more eloquently. Please welcome Dr. Rob Pepper to the show and on with the interview. Dr. Pepper, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. There was something big that you said in the book that stood out that's going to connect us to the work you do. Relationships harm us, but they can also heal us.
Exactly right.
So how do you bring that to group therapy?
Well, that's a great question. I should back up a little bit and say that I'm writing a third book, and the title of the book is The Golden Rule, The Unconscious Rules. And one of the chapters in that book is called Sea Turtles Don't Need Group Therapy. And it's a humorous title, but it makes the point that sea turtles never know their parents. So my idea is that anybody who has parents is a good candidate for group therapy. So that's everybody, right? I mean, so we learn who we are through our family relationships. And quite frankly, when I meet people as patients and I do an interview, the intake interview, most people come for individual therapy, usually with either a complaint of anxiety or depression or some combination of the two. And while they're talking, if they mention anything about problems with relationships, I'll say to them, I think group therapy could help with that, kind of get them ready for the idea of it. And most people will not at first want to go into group. In fact, if somebody is too anxious to go into group in the beginning, I'm suspicious, because some people see it as a chance to meet people. It's not a social function, it's therapy. But the reason I think people are hesitant to get into group, because they assume that that therapy group will be their first group, which is the family of origin. And who wants to repeat that? So people are reluctant to get into it. They don't understand what group is. And sometimes it's even more pronounced than that. Like, I had seen a fellow not long ago who told me that he had come for the interview at the request, or actually the insistence, of his girlfriend, who said, if you don't get some help, I'm leaving you. So he really wasn't a willing participant. So he gave me his spin. And by the way, I'll tell you about that in a second. So he tells me about his spin, and I say to him, you know, I think group could help with that. And he says, well, I'm not interested in group. And I said, well, why not? He said, because I'm not interested in other people's problems. And I said, well, that's the problem.
Right.
That's the problem. People come with a spin. Individual therapy, everybody has a story. For better or worse, people have a story. And they tell that story. But in group, they play it out. I see it. We see it in front. And one of the best examples in that, I think I write about it in that book. I had seen a woman for about a year in individual therapy alone. And she complained bitterly in that year about how she was being mistreated by her wicked stepsisters. And any attempt on my part to get her to take a look at, well, what part did you play in this? Because I was suspicious. It couldn't be all everybody else. And she was insistent. So by the end of a year, I said, look, I think group could be of help to you. And she was reluctant at first, but she trusted me enough. So I put her into one of my groups. Don't you know that within the first 45 minutes of that group, she verbally abused every woman in that group? To the point I said to her, I think you better be quiet, just listen for a while. But what I was really thinking is, if this continues, I'm going to have to remove you from the group. You can't be in a group like this. But I learned more about her relationship to women in that 45 minutes than a whole year of what she told me.
Right. What she was telling you about her relationship with her sisters compared to what you were seeing with her relationship to right. The other women in the group.
She was determined to play the victim. She was the victim. I'm going to say something controversial. In adult relationships, there are really no victims, only volunteers. I mean, to some extent, and when there's physical abuse, that's another story. But most people select a partner. It's all unconscious. And that's one of my main points, is that we're often driven by a force that that's out of our awareness. And most people don't want to accept that.
Is that the subconscious where people are saying you're acting from your subconscious?
Unconscious. Unconscious means it's out of their awareness. Subconscious is, if I said to you, what did you have for dinner on Friday night? If you think about it for a few minutes, you'll recall it. That's subconscious. Unconscious, you don't even know it's happening. It's out of conscious awareness. So people who come for individual want attention. People who come to group seek help with relationships.
Before reading the book, I went right to, when I think about group therapy, I think it's for people who can't afford individual therapy. And so they get placed in a group because it's less expensive.
Well, unfortunately, you're right to some extent. For a long time, group therapy was the, talk about stepchild, the unwanted stepchild of individual therapy. But within the last, I'd say 25, maybe 30 years, group therapy has become a modality of its own, with legitimacy of its own. In fact, the American Psychological Association has finally recognized group therapy as a separate modality. I have colleagues who only do individual therapy. And the thought is, well, you just put people in a room. Anybody can lead a group. It's not like that. It's a special skill.
Right.
One guy that I know said, he told me he's an individual therapist. He's going to start a group. I said, well, you've never been in a group. You've never trained group. He said, well, I'm reading a book about doing group. And I thought,
that's all it takes.
Within a month, that group folded. It folded.
You mentioned in the book that, you know, even though you have years and years of experience, you make mistakes here and there.
All the time.
And encourage the group members to call you out on them.
Well, part of what I think a group member's responsibility is to make me a better therapist. That's their job, to make me a better parent.
Yeah. And you talk, you know, going back to what you mentioned before with, you know, it kind of, if you have parents, you need group therapy, right? But I noticed in a couple of the stories of the sessions that you talk about in the book that they come back to your mother a lot of times, or a couple of times in particular, I noticed people reminded you of your mother.
My mother, right. Well, look, we all... people who become therapists do it for a reason, too. In my particular case, my role as a kid growing up was to take care of my mother, to protect my mother. So it's the good news and the bad news. Part of my adult motivation to become a therapist, I'm sure, is related to my childhood. Everybody's got an unconscious, even therapists. The problem is when people don't really take that seriously, they don't take their unconscious into account. But when I first started writing this book, I showed some chapters to my brilliant daughter, and she said, Dad, you're writing about your mistakes. Why are you doing that? I said, who wants to read a book about somebody's successes all the time? I couldn't imagine anybody wanting to read it.
I think it makes you very authentic and honest.
Oh, I'm glad you say that. Right. Did you read the chapter called The Infant in Kindergarten, when I put a woman in group too soon?
Yes. Yes. Is it she, the one who curled up in the fetal position?
Yes. Right. Right. Isn't that, that was a great lesson for me that, first of all, not everybody's ready for group at the same time, and not every group is right for every person. So I may make mistakes all the time. And I tell my groups, I make at least 3 mistakes every group. Your job is to figure it out. Point them out to me. Tell me my mistakes. And, you know, I find that if I open to admitting my mistakes, it helps people to accept their own frailties and fallibility.
Right. I like that. Here's something that came up. We have 3 bedrock needs. This is from the book. We have 3 bedrock needs for emotional survival: to be loved, to be accepted, and to be understood.
Right.
And I'm thinking that's probably why Tom Hanks created Wilson when he was on the island in Castaway, right? For his emotional needs were not being met. It created it.
Remember his heartbreak when Wilson floated away?
Yes.
That was separation anxiety.
Yeah, amazing. So with those being needs for emotional survival, those can only be met, those 3, to be loved, accepted, and understood, in the context of relationships.
Of a relationship. That's right. And that's why I said relationships can harm and they can cure. We develop our sense of ourselves. Like I said, in many families, children are the identified good one, smart one, dumb one, screw up, black sheep. And those identities stay through adult life. In a well-running group, you can't get rid of those voices. They stay. There was a famous sociologist called Charles Cooley who talked about the looking glass self. And the group is a looking glass self. It holds up a mirror for people to see how they come across, because most people don't know how they come across in relationships. And so that creates havoc. So in the group, people learn to incorporate other voices, aside from the ones that they've grown up with, more benign voices, softer voices that are more accepting, and that gets incorporated, and that's the healing. Relationships heal in that way, with the disclaimer that, and one of the things I talk about in this book, but more so in my first book, is about boundaries, that in order for a group to really heal a person, there has to be some sense of the structure of a group and boundaries. By that I mean people are only known to each other in the group. There's no outside contact with.
Right.
Some people don't practice that way, and that's their style. But mine is, I want everything in the group for two reasons. First of all, it protects confidentiality. And second, it makes it more intense. When everything happens in the group, it's more of an intense experience.
I think you even say you have a rule with your groups that there's no socializing outside the group.
I do. Now, obviously, people default on, I have a contract with the group. It's not really a contract in the legal sense, but the contract is I'm looking for what I call progressive emotional communication with between members. Progressive is the relationship moves forward. It's emotional in that it's infused with feelings, and it's communication because it's interactive. That's the larger goal. In order to do that, I do what I call called bridging, a technique where I get people to talk to each other rather than at each other. And I say the contract is members are supposed to say how they feel towards each other and why they feel that way. And of course, they default on it, which is what I want, because it shows me when people default on the contract, it shows me their unique ways of messing up their own relationships on the outside.
Let's come up with an example of that. Is there any connection, like your group is talking to each other, somebody may turn and respond to you instead of the person who was talking?
Right.
And you're redirecting?
Right.
So, and is it a connection to you? I want to try to remember what I read about when somebody says, I feel that you're crazy. It's not really a feeling. And it's an opportunity for you to see how they're typically talking to people.
Exactly. Most people don't know the difference between a feeling and a thought. As soon as a person says, I feel that, they're off the feeling into a thought. Feeling statements are, I feel sad, happy. And there are also differences between self feelings and interpersonal feelings. Sad is a self feeling. Love is an interpersonal feeling. There's a whole range of, I have patients who in the beginning don't know a difference. They actually printed out emojis off the internet and come out with a cheat sheet that they've handed out to other people. It's hysterical.
You're welcome, Gen Z.
Yeah. Like that. So an example would be in the chapter called The Narcissistic Group. It's a story about how people, it starts off with a story about this woman comes into group and she's talking about how she's landed the job of a lifetime and how happy she was to get this job. And somebody responds about how happy they are for her. They know how hard she worked for this. So instead of responding to the person and saying how her compliment made me feel, the woman goes off and says, well, this is a great job for me because I'm in contact with the big movers and shakers in my profession. So she goes off back into herself, talking about how good the job. So I said to her, whatever, the names in the group, by the way, are not the real people's names. So,
right.
So I'll say, Teresa is talking to you about you, and you're talking to her about you. You have a feeling toward her. A feeling? Oh, thank you. Thank you for, and I'll say, thank you is what you say to a waiter when he, thank you is not a feeling.
Thank you is what to say to a waiter when he hands you a menu.
Right. Isn't that a good line?
That's I like it. Uh-huh. Yeah, I want to go back, finish that sentiment, because I want to go back and talk about those stoppers.
Right. So eventually the woman was emotionally in touch enough to finally say to Teresa, what you just said means a lot to me. So that's a feeling. So then it was a complete act. That's the difference between people not being aware of how they're coming across. And I would assume she does that in her personal life too. Some people in group don't respond at all. They withdraw. And people have a reaction to their withdrawal from the group. And I've said on more than one occasion, when someone withdraws from an emotional interchange, mm-hmm. I'll say to the other person, I'll say, Bill doesn't understand how his withdrawal hurts other people. And that's an awakening to the one people are so self-absorbed,
right.
Realize they have it. Their withdrawal has an impact.
And right. They're withdrawing because they have feelings,
but they don't want to
talk. But not concerned about how that is impacting others.
And there was a
great line. You said the key to any successful relationship is the ability to anticipate the impact on others of one's words and actions.
Right. And in fact, I'm glad you're bringing up a great question. People often ask me, how do I know when I'm finished with group therapy? And what I say to them is, when you can do for yourself what the group does for you, then you're ready to go, which is exactly that. If I say this, it will have this reaction. If I that people learning how to anticipate what interpersonal reactions will be is the key. I mean, eventually people go. You want them. The only people who don't leave therapy are other therapists. When I was in my own therapy practice, a supervisor said to me, "Look, all the practice, we're only therapists because they never leave treatment."
Oh. Yeah, you know, you have that. Friends and family. I heard in another book I read, I want to say it was somebody who did something with Oprah, right? Yeah. Okay. In combination. And they were saying, you know, if you have a great enough network of friends and family, you know, people close to you, you may not need therapy. That might be it. Like, that connection is the cure. But you say friends and family cannot replace group therapy, it can only complement it. Right. And you go on to explain why, and it made so much sense. I don't want to ask you if you remember, because you probably know, but can you share why it's not the same? And for me, there's just that holding back part as a friend.
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, for the most part, friends and family have a particular investment in what you do. They're not objective. They really are not objective. That's one thing. Group can provide feedback in an environment where there's no outside consequence. That's why I insist on people not having contact. Because you can say, you know, so often this happens in real life. Somebody comes to me in my personal life with a complaint about their spouse or relative or what, and they complain to me about it. And I'm getting all heated up as a person about what this other person is doing to my friend or whatever. Then they kiss and make up. But then I'm stuck with the feelings because I'm still angry at that person.
Right. I say it like, I try not to say the worst about my life partner to someone else, because I know I may forgive them, but my best friend won't.
Right. That's right. And the other thing is, when people don't realize that when they complain about someone that this, like their spouse, they're really talking about themselves. Unless someone put a gun to your head, I can say to a patient, what's your part in this? In my real life, people don't want to hear that when they're complaining about
it. Right.
They don't want to know what their part. They just want to dump. So,
yeah, I've come to start asking my friends, do you need to vent or do you want advice? What do you need from me right now?
Right.
Because when it comes down to it, you have those conversations with friends, and there's certain things that you may assess in the moment that you can't tell them.
That's right.
Without breaking their heart or risking the relationship. Your relationship with them, if you are honest in a way that is not a safe space. And I think that the group creates the safe space to hear the hard news.
Yes, with the condition that there's no contact outside. Then all bets are off. But I've found that for the most part, people don't really want advice. They want to be told what they already think.
They want validation.
I
have friends say that to me. I said, what do you need from me right now as a friend? Validation.
I'll say to people, if they ask me for advice, I'll say on two conditions. First, you tell me how you feel about what I'm saying. And second, you follow it. Because if you're not going to follow it, what's the point? But I make an exception when it comes to kids. People who have problems with their children, I believe, really genuinely feel helpless. And they do need advice. So when people come in with problems with their children, then I'm more willing to give my opinion. But for the most part, you know, they come to me, they want to know, patients ask me, should I marry someone or should I have an abortion? I can't make that decision for you. It's really up to you. I mean, can you imagine? And some of them come in with that agenda. They'll say, well, should I get a divorce? And I'll say, well, that's not really a question. Because if I say get a divorce, it's my response. If I say don't get a divorce, then I'm telling you to stay with this person. So,
and to a certain extent, you only know what you know from them.
Well, that's another thing too.
Right. There could be so many factors.
Everybody has a spin. In fact, that happened the other night. I, I have somebody that I saw individually, and he's complaining bitterly about what was going between him and his wife. And he's painting himself as a victim. Well, I saw the two of them as a couple. And stuff came out in the couple that was clear that he was provoking something. It wasn't just that he was a victim. He was actually doing that. Didn't come out in the individual. Because like I said in the beginning, people have a spin. They tell you a story that's self-serving, even if it's negative, even if it's negative. So in the group, it happens. And it's the most challenging and also the most rewarding thing I can do, because it really demands that I think on my feet as it's happening. How do I deal with this? One occasion I was working with in a group, a fellow who was a very angry guy, he had explosive temper. If someone jostled him on the subway, he'd throw them on the platform. I mean, he was in trouble with the law. So anyway, big guy, 6'5", or four, over 300 pounds. He was a martial arts expert. I was spending too much time talking to somebody else, and he started to get jealous. So he gets up out of his seat. And that's another rule. You're not supposed to get out of your seat. And he starts walking toward me. He starts menacing me. And he could have broken my neck with one hand. So I told him, sit down and talk. And he just kept coming. So I finally said to him, look, if you kill me, you'll be killing your group analyst. That got his attention. He sat down.
Like, if you don't feel bad for me, think about the others here.
So, I mean, I diffused it, but it happens. Aggression comes out in group. And unless a person is a skilled therapist, they won't know how to deal with it. To be a good therapist, you have to be adept at dealing your own aggression and not give it back to people. It's too easy to give it back, and that does damage, or not be able to handle someone else's aggression.
I want to go back before I forget to go back. I talked about the interaction stoppers.
Right.
So I want to talk about the interaction stoppers, because this is brought in the context of group therapy. And I believe it holds true in our own personal relationship interactions.
Absolutely.
So the example with somebody gives you glowing compliment. Oh my gosh, you worked so hard for that. I'm so happy for you. Even a thank you is too simple.
Right.
Right. So, well, in the context of a romantic relationship, let me use that one. And, you know, to circle on that story, you had told it earlier, is coming back with, I appreciate your compliment. Oh, that makes me feel better. So they're both feeling good now from it and expressing that. But there's the romantic relationship when someone says, we've seen it on sitcoms, we've seen it in movies, I love you. And the response, thank you.
Yes, right. Thank you.
Right. Because you don't necessarily feel it back, but I'll let you take it from here.
Well, but it's also to say, I love you. The person is making himself vulnerable. And the expectation is the other person will do the same. But some people draw back from making himself vulnerable and they'll give an answer like that. Thank you. So, or they may not even mean it. You know, I mean, it gets complicated at those points. People have, when you take a risk, you say to someone, I love you. Well, you're taking a risk that's not reciprocal. So, and even if it is, the other person may be so defended about making themselves vulnerable, they'll give you thank you.
You know what? I had an interesting experience happen not that long ago. And there is, after I read in the book, how you convey a nicer way to, you know, the proper way to express.
A more emotionally authentic way.
A more emotionally authentic way. I feel like I did the right thing. I had been approached. I'm going to say I have a friend who probably never listens to this, so it's safe. I have a friend whose adult child asked me out.
No kidding.
An adult child that I have known since they are shorter than me and everybody's taller than me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my first thought was like, was every curse word in the world. How do I deal with this?
Right, right, right.
And luckily it was by text, because that's the generation, right? And I responded, I have never read a more romantic and flattering message in my life. And you are family to me. I can't go in that direction, but you will always have me in your life as a friend, mentor, second mom.
That's wonderful. So sweet.
And he responded, thank you so much for answering in that way.
You set up boundaries for him.
He was conveying the way I handled it made him feel good.
Without stepping on his shine by telling him no.
Right.
That was great. Brilliant.
Yeah. Am I an example for the next book or what?
Absolutely. You'll be the title. I'll call it an ode to you.
Thank you. One more thing I want to go back to, because you brought up the progressive emotional communication.
Right.
And that stood out to me because of our Agile theme, that we are here to progress incrementally, right, iteratively. It's not an overnight process. So can we go back and refine, talk about what that means in terms of our relationships in our lives?
That's right. And it takes time and it takes work because it doesn't come naturally. It doesn't come naturally.
What would that mean between, let's say, relationship with me and my mother? If I'm looking for a progressive emotional communication, what does that mean? What am I working towards when we say progressive?
Give me an example. Can you give me an example of
She makes me crazy.
How? How does she do it?
Wait, is that a feeling?
Well, when someone
I feel makes frustrated.
Crazy, what they mean is it makes them angry. When someone says
it makes me angry.
Yeah.
She makes me angry because she asks for advice and refuses to take it.
There you go. So why don't you say to her, look, if you want my advice, you got to take it. Otherwise, I'm wasting my breath.
So what makes it progressive?
What progressive is stopping this dynamic between the two of you where you think she's really interested in what you have to say without necessarily stepping on her toes. You know, I mean, she doesn't really want your advice. She just wants to hear. I mean, I don't know your mother, obviously.
No.
But it's a pattern where she asks for something, but so.
She wants validation.
What do you really want, Ma? What do you really want? What's behind the question? What would she say? Ma, what are you really asking me?
I just want to vent. Was probably it.
Uh-huh. Okay. So how do you feel about that?
I want you to fix it for me, but I don't want to change anything I'm doing.
That would be very honest on her part. Is she,
right?
Would she say that to you? I can't fix it.
No, she does. She's not self-aware like that.
No. Like, Ma, I can't fix it. I love you the way you are.
You know what?
No, what?
Yeah, I can't fix it. I have come to say that, like, I would love to help you. And when you're ready to take my help, I will be there.
Sometimes you, can I tell you a quick story about my mom?
Yeah.
So I used to take my mom for lunch every Sunday. And as she got older and she became more infirm, started to lose it. One Sunday afternoon, we're taking a drive. And in the middle of just driving quietly, she says to me, if an old woman like me came to your office for a consultation, what would you recommend? So I thought for a second. I said, I'd recommend that you pay me in advance. And it was a split second of silence, and then she burst out laughing. She got it, you know.
Yeah.
It was a cute moment. It was a sweet moment toward the end there.
We're going to go on to the speed round, but the biggest, I just want to bring it all back.
Should I be nervous about this?
No, not at all. I'm safe. But the title of the book, Some People Don't Want What They Say They Want, that the idea comes from the fact that people say they want to improve their relationships while they are resisting the change. So in order for you to make that change, what is it you need to stop resisting?
Any change, even if it's for the best, is stressful. It's a question of being able to live with the stress of change and move forward. You know, there's a law in physics that says for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. We take two steps forward, there's always a back step. You have to be prepared for a long process. It doesn't happen overnight because nothing of value comes easily. It's work. You have to be prepared to do the work and realize, despite the fact that you want to change, there's a part of all of us that resists the change because it will make us anxious to change. And that needs to be addressed. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. So you have a fear of change. I feel like I remember there were kind of two parts to it. A fear of change and a fear of the anxiety.
The change, right.
Of the change.
Right.
Like, I'll just avoid anxiety. I'm going to get anxiety. So I'll just avoid that altogether. And if I try to change, I'm going to get anxious.
Anxiety is a symptom of conflict. We get anxious because we're in conflict about something. We may not even know what the conflict is. In this case, the change itself is conflicted. We want it and we don't want it. Because all basic emotions are duality. We want intimacy, we want separation, we seek stability, we like excitement. All emotions are based, we love somebody. It's hard to admit sometimes we actually hate the person that we love, but a colleague of mine did a group for adolescent girls. She called it the Why Do I Hate My Parents group. It was a very successful group. Kids can talk about the other side of it. When people tell me that the kids say negative things, I say, that's a compliment to you. They're telling you both sides of it. It's not an insult. Listen, you don't have to do anything. Just listen. Sometimes the best we can do for someone is just to listen. You don't have to fix it. You don't have to change it. It's hard.
And in our, you know, the new agey world, we say hold space.
Hold space. Very good. All right. So hit me with the
speed round, and then we'll talk about how to find you and your books. Okay. Name one item in your junk drawer.
Broken pens.
I think the same thing. Because you and I met through my dad, when I was clearing out his office, my father must have had about 10,000 pens, and they all had his name on it. He loved ordering promotional pens. Uh-huh.
I have a couple of his pens.
Yeah, I bet you do. And little calendars. And okay.
By the way, I love your father.
I do too. If you could have a robot take over one chore in your home, what would it be?
First thing that came to my mind is cleaning the toilet.
Oh, yeah. First movie you remember seeing at a theater?
Ben-Hur.
If you had a time machine, where or when would you like to visit?
The Belle Epoque in France, the end of the 19th century, France. The age of the, you know, the Impressionist painters and the
culture center.
Yeah.
And last question, what website do you visit most often?
My own.
Do you?
I want to see who's contacting me. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say Google, but I searched right from the top of the browser. Unfortunately, it's probably Facebook. Okay. That's it for the speed round. Now let's tell people, how can they, are you still running groups?
Yes, I am.
How can people find you?
Go to my website, drpepperphd.com. Everything.
Okay. Not the soda, everybody. drpepperphd.com.
By the way, I got a letter from a woman saying, Dr. Pepper, I'm really upset with you. I love your soda, but the last batch had no fizz. Did you change the formula? So I wrote back, dear madam, I think you have the wrong Dr. Pepper. I'm a doctor of psychotherapy, not physics. And I spelled it F-I-Z-Z-I-C.
Is that a therapist joke? Only for Dr. Peppers.
So there's a link on the website to the Amazon for the books. There's my blog, email, well, anything you want, a picture of me, if you care what I look like.
And where do you operate out of?
I am in Forest Hills, Queens. I have a private practice here, and I'm back in person. You know, for a long time it was online, but I'm doing in-person groups now again, and I love going back. It's the only way the only way to do it. So in Queens, Forest Hills, Queens.
In Queens. So if you're in the area,
right,
look up Dr. Pepper PhD.
.com.
And this is the part before I let you off the hook. Is there anything you wanted to say or talk about that you didn't have a chance to?
Yeah, the importance of boundaries and how patients get taken advantage of by therapists who exploit dependency needs of their patients. The therapist is supposed to know better. And so many of the people that I know, and I guess it's scary, it's an alarming thing to think, but don't know better. And they do things. Well, if you wanted to, we could have another talk.
Interesting. I think that'd be a great conversation about having boundaries within therapy.
Yes, absolutely.
And what's your next book about?
It's about how it's called The Unconscious Rules, how we're so driven by unconscious process, we don't even realize what are the forces that are driving us, and we repeat the same mistakes over and again.
And when is that coming out?
It's coming out hopefully this summer. I'm in the middle of writing it now.
2023.
Yeah.
All right, gonna let you off the hook now and hit that stop button.
Cool, thanks.
Thank you for joining me. Visit agileselfdevelopment.com and subscribe to the podcast so you can receive new episodes right when they're released. And if you enjoyed the podcast, I'd love it if you'd leave a review in Apple Podcasts. It makes a big difference in how the podcasts are ranked. Thank you again for joining me, Helene Coppell, for this episode of Agile Self-Development. Become your best self, one version at a time. Catch you soon.